Hello and welcome to IR Voice, the IR Magazine podcast, formerly known as the Ticket Podcast. I'm your host, Noemi Di Stefano. This month, we dive into the depths of SEC filings. We speak to Michelle Leader, author, SEC filings expert, and founder of Footnoted, a firm that for the past 20 years has had one main mission, uncovering companies' hidden signals within SEC filings. But before we hear about some uncovered truths, let's explore how artificial intelligence is influencing and reshaping the way the buy side makes their investment decisions. Stephanie Mollin, Global Equities Portfolio Manager at London-headquartered GIB Asset Management, joins us on the show to shed some light on the way asset managers' use of AI has changed over the past decade, what this means for IR teams, and if and how it's time for IROs to rethink the ways and methods of delivering companies' information to their shareholders. And this is coming up now on IR Voice. Stephanie Mollin, Global Equities Portfolio Manager at GIB Asset Management, welcome to IR Voice. It's a pleasure to have you on the show this month.
It's a pleasure to be here, Noemi. Thank you.
Thank you. And to start with, Stephanie, for those listeners who maybe have not heard about you or GIB, can you maybe tell us a little bit about the work that you do and your background?
Certainly. So a bit of background about myself. I recently joined GIB Asset Management as a global portfolio manager for our Sustainable World Fund. I have over 20 years of investment experience, having held portfolio manager roles at Allianz Global Investors and most recently at Unigestion. And GIB Asset Management, for some background there, is a multi-thematic, sustainability-led investment boutique manager. We have over $6 billion in assets under management. And our investment philosophy is based on our view that the greatest opportunities lie in solving the greatest challenges facing both people and the planet. So to that end, our investment process is focused on identifying the world's largest social and environmental challenges and finding at those companies whose products and services provide lasting solutions. And our expectation is that those types of companies will see sustainable long-term growth in demand and also growth in their performance.
Great. And thank you for that intro. Maybe to start the conversation around AI, you were recently at one of our events, the AI for IR Forum. You were one of the panelists at a session that looked at how the asset management industry is integrating AI into the investment process. So I would be interested in learning a little bit more about how you use AI in your day to day and maybe how that use of these tools has changed as the technology basically advances at fast pace, I would say.
So just thinking about how we have used AI and technology generally in the investment process and how that's evolved over the past 10 years, and I've had more than 20 years in the business. So if we look back 10 years ago, I relied on analyzing data from data providers such as Bloomberg or FactSet primarily through the use of Excel. So, you know, further information and data would have also typically been gathered through search engines like Google. And I would have incorporated that into the proprietary financial models that we were building in Excel.
Okay.
So and our investment ideas would then be presented using your usual Microsoft applications, PowerPoint or Word. And technology might have been used to create bespoke investment research templates and firm-wide. We were using off-the-shelf software, something like a Salesforce, to allow us to internally generate the research that we were using for our stock recommendations. And, you know, we also had some personalized off-the-shelf software, which we would use to track analyst recommendation performance. And what else did we use? Communication across the investment team. So this is back 10 years ago, would have been through bespoke chat platforms. So we were able to tag internally and externally generated research and insights. But a lot of this, really, if you think about it, was using the Microsoft suite of applications and getting our data from data sources that we still use. And then if you think back, fast forward 5 years, so around 5 years ago, we're still using Bloomberg and FactSet for financial and economic data as these inputs into our financial models, along with data from research on companies and sectors that we're getting through the internet, through search, through company websites, and continuing to track recommendation performance. And so the use of technologies became more sophisticated back 5 years ago as we started to incorporate things like optimization models to help in portfolio construction and stock picking. But that's still not that unusual, I guess. More interestingly, I would say about 3 or 4 years ago, I started to apply AI directly into the investment process in the form of natural language processing. So I was using NLP algorithms to identify stocks, corporate entities that would be linked to a theme. So we were trying to categorize and bucket stocks according to themes. So analysts, for example, would be asked to put together keywords for the theme. A list of stocks would be generated for each theme through the NLP algorithms. And then the analysts and the portfolio managers would come back and check that list to see if it really fit the theme or it was investable. So the benefit of using the NLP algorithm was to incorporate less well-known stocks within that theme, things that we wouldn't have thought of naturally ourselves. Yeah. And it also allowed us to classify the entire investable universe according to our themes or eliminate the non-theme aligned stocks. Mm-hmm. So that was something we were using back then, and that's 3 or 4 years ago. And I can talk to you a little bit about how we're using it today, which is a little bit different as again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was going to ask you if you could share like one of the, what is your favorite way of using AI today and for what kind of data do you find it particularly effective?
Sure. So today, and this is, you know, the how we're using it currently in terms of AI applications. So there's one side of it which has improved efficiency in the investment process. So the part where we're building models and creating spreadsheets for data retrieval from data sets. So we can use, you know, for example, ChatGPT or Copilot to quickly create formulas in Excel, right, to help speed up that process of building models. Another application that we use is something, I mean, there are many, but the one we use particularly is something called Otter, which automates meeting notes and creates summaries with action items. So you don't have to sit there taking notes furiously and then trying to summarize them later. This is doing it automatically. So that's helping improve efficiency. And then another side, to speed up the aggregation and the summarizing of company-specific and sector-specific information, we're using a third-party application called Quarter Pro. And in that, really amazing in that we can do a keyword search. So if we're looking, for example, for what's happening within an industry about destocking, or we're looking for specific KPIs, we can enter that into Quarter, this third-party application, and it will find all the relevant information across company slides, filings, transcripts, and as well give us a link to the original underlying data. So rather than me going through hundreds of different companies' presentations, this application will do it for me. And so it speeds things up.
That's really, really great. It sounds like it saves a lot of time.
Yes.
So you mentioned earlier that you still use more traditional tools like the Bloomberg or FactSet. So then how do you balance the use of this latest generation's AI tool with the more traditional ones in your decision-making process, basically?
So the investment process and the stock selection process still is very much based on our forecasting of earnings and therefore the earnings potential of companies, and what goes into that is all this company research. But we need to start with, you know, the basics of the financials of the company, which we still definitely are relying on data sets that are coming from things like Bloomberg. We're also using Bloomberg for other areas of company research, as well as portfolio attribution. So that's still very important. And there are parts within Bloomberg as well, because they've continue to progress using AI themselves, they have tools that we also use. Yeah. So, for example, there's a tool on Bloomberg called NewsTrend, which will show us the most negative and the most positive topics coming from social media, as well as news trends on a company or on an industry. And that it gives us a very good sense of what the market is focused on, and also what non-investment professionals are focused on, which is particularly important for investing in consumer-facing stocks, right? So that's kind of a sentiment analysis. So we're using both. So, you know, the investment approach is really what I would call an AI plus HI model. So artificial intelligence and human intelligence model, where these AI tools are helping us improve our investment performance, reducing our time spent on what's more routine and repetitive, and allowing us to spend more time on piecing together different pieces of information and ideas to come up with our final investment decision. So in the end, all these are AI and technological tools are really just that, tools that are deployed by investors who we will make that final decision.
Okay. And I mean, in the picture that you've painted, like going through how the use has evolved for you over the past 10 years, definitely the improvement is there. I'm curious to find out, as the pace really speaking up of how fast these tools are evolving, is there something that you would like to do with an AI powered tool that you can't do just yet?
So I think what we are considering or already using these tools for is to free up our time as investors, as analysts and portfolio managers, to spend on what we would call, you know, alternative data sources as a way of generating more alpha. So the more that we can use AI to reduce the time that we're spending on creating these financial models and digging for extra information, you know, if we can get that faster, that frees up time to do things where there is the ability to generate more alpha that is an alternative data source, such as, you know, areas which are purely based on human interaction. So spending more time at things like trade shows or visiting companies that are not on a roadshow or meeting with companies that aren't listed, you know, so we'll have more time to do those kind of things, which can provide alpha sources or information that we can't get by utilizing AI, which could inform better investment decisions.
Okay, and just the last question on that evolution. I know this was like one of the questions at the forum. As AI evolves, so how do you think the dynamics between large and small asset managers will change? What is your view on that?
So, Naomi, I think over the next 5 years, I'd expect the bulk of asset managers to be utilizing AI in some form. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because a recent survey that I read was saying that less than 20% of asset managers today think they're in a position to take advantage of AI. And that should certainly evolve, because their expectation in the survey was within 5 years, 80% of them would be using AI. Now, the barriers to AI use can be linked to the cost for those managers who want to build their own tools in-house. That said, smaller asset managers will have a suite of third-party providers for tools like the ones I mentioned. Those are low cost. In fact, I think these AI tools that are off the shelf, so to speak, may level the playing field for smaller asset managers, because it will allow or provide access to data that is more alternative, so not yet mainstream, or give access to unstructured data, so data that's not in a format that's easily processed, you know, so text or image or voice format. So I think it levels the playing field. I do believe that large asset managers will be able to use their resources to generate new data sources and insight. They used to be able to conduct proprietary surveys that now, using AI, one can do their own research by looking on information that wasn't, and data that wasn't available before. So using, you know, alternative data like GPS information that's publicly available about, you know, how many cars are being seen outside of particular shopping malls, for example, whereas in the past you would have had to send a person out there to count how many cars or how many people.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of resource. Now that's available to everyone. And so I think it levels the playing field to a certain extent.
Okay, thank you for offering your views on that. As these capital markets become more and more AI driven, from your perspective, how do you expect the IR teams to change and adapt the way they communicate their company narrative and their value proposition to you?
Well, I think there are a few key points that investor relation teams should keep in mind about how AI is being used by the investment community. First, one thing I think IR teams should consider are which themes or sub-industries they want their company to be associated with, and then ensure that the company's press releases and documents have those particular keywords peppered about, because investors will use natural language processing to help categorize stocks. I mean, that's something we're already doing. Another area that the IR teams might want to think about is, or work focus on, is maintaining your own brand sentiment tracker so that those teams can be aware of any changes. And it's not, you know, just to be on top of what's happening in terms of social media sentiment and news sentiment about the company. And then the teams could, if it's not correct, or if they want to counter the message or come out with a different message, the investor relations teams can come out with their own press releases. So I think the team having a market awareness of social media and news sentiment is very important, because that obviously influences the share price, magnifies the impact of what is already driving share prices. So being aware of that and being able to counter or to mold the narrative is in the hands of those teams. Another point or area which I think the investor relation teams should think about or focus on is consider AI when they're scripting their earnings calls. So there are tools which I think you could call sentiment trackers or company messaging trackers. So AI-driven insights can be very helpful for getting a steer on a company from a psychological point of view. So it's a sentiment analysis on the transcript. So a key component of a sentiment model, it analyzes the language coming from management in their conference calls. Okay. So as an example, a conference call deception model, it can be created, which focuses on four components of deception. So the model will look at things like company management through omission, so the failure to disclose key details. It'll focus on a second point of spin, so if the management's exaggerating or has overly scripted language. A third point that this type of deception model will focus on is obfuscation, so an overly complicated story. And the final point it will focus on is blame, so the deflection of responsibility.
Yeah.
So the investment community will use a deception model, and if what's coming out of it is that there's some deception in what is being told by management, then the information from that conference call will be discounted, right? Or could even be taken negatively. So from an investor relations team's perspective, when they're scripting those earnings calls, they should be conscious of what these models look for. So to avoid overcomplication, avoid blame and exaggeration, and avoid omitting topics or data points that the management team typically talk about. So I think that's something to keep in mind when scripting those calls.
Okay.
So
keywords, market awareness, and considering AI when scripting earning calls. Those are, if I understand correctly, your three things that will
those
make
be...
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, and I think just one other thing for the teams to be aware of is that when there's this going to be a period of transition as investors and asset managers use AI, but at different paces. So I think you'll have a period, and it could be quite a long time, where the investor relations teams need to be prepared to answer questions from two different almost investor set groups. So there'll be one who is using AI will have may have very detailed questions on market shares and consumer volumes, things that they're getting new data that the company might is not generating themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that you might get questions that are coming from a totally different angle and very detailed versus your more traditional investor questions that you already, these investor relation teams are, would already be prepared to answer. And because it's something they've, you know, they've always been answering. So you might get these unusual and very granular questions from one set of investors and much more generic, not generic, but you know, the typical questions that you would be prepared. Yeah, so you almost have two investor groups to deal with for a period of time.
Okay, and I mean, one last question. I wanted to ask you if you had any success stories or lessons learned from instances where AI-driven insights have led you to good investment outcomes.
Sure, with pleasure. So where it's been super beneficial is when identifying stocks linked to either themes or sub-industries through the use of natural language processing, I have uncovered companies that I really wouldn't have associated with that industry or service. So there were lots of things in the past, I think, that fell through the cracks, lots of companies, usually smaller ones, where they had really interesting and very focused operations on a particular area where I saw sustainable growth that I uncovered by the use of NLP and these keywords. And so some of those stocks were actually really helpful to the portfolio performance. And, you know, I wouldn't have come up with that using more traditional routes to categorize stocks.
That's great. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for sharing your experience of how you use AI and all the insights. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show this month.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
IR Magazine invites you to read its latest IR playbook, Growing and Engaging Your Online Investor Audience, sponsored by Reef by Totem. The report delves into the pivotal role of digital engagement for companies in today's capital markets. It offers insights into crafting a compelling online presence, managing investor content effectively, and how to measure success. Key findings highlight the importance of earnings materials, the demand for diverse media assets, and the necessity of formal content plans to update your IR website. The research also brings you the investor perspective and gives you best practice advice on how to successfully craft your company communications and foster lasting investor relationships. To read the report today, head over to the research tab at iMagazine.com.
Thanks again to Stephanie Mullin from GIB Asset Management for sharing her insights on the buy-side use of AI. We will now hear from IR Magazine Deputy Editor Garnet Roach in conversation with Michelle Leader, founder of Footnoted. And a quick disclaimer that the companies mentioned in the conversation have all been approached by IR Magazine for comment.
Welcome to this episode. We've got Michelle Leader, founder of Footnoted. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we are talking to SEC influencers. And how would you describe yourself?
I am a person who, I guess, I don't know, the Queen of Edgar, the Kim Kardashian of SEC filings. No, I have been reading SEC filings very closely for the past 20 years. And, you know, there's just a lot of really interesting things buried deep in the filings. And I love finding them.
How did you come to this? How did you discover this kind of wealth of interesting stuff in there?
So I came to it actually very personally. You know, I had been the first 10 years of my career, I had been a business journalist. And so I thought like I knew something, you know, more than other people about stocks and investing because I had been writing about it for 10 years. And I bought shares of a company called Quest Communications, which has now been folded into some other company. And I thought like, oh, you know, I watched my investment grow. And, you know, I was in my late 20s at the time. So, you know, it was a small amount of money, but it meant a lot to me. And all of a sudden, the stock started tanking. And when I went back and I looked at the SEC, I was like, wait, the press releases are all saying things are great. How could this be? And I went back and I looked at the SEC filings, and I saw a lot of hidden clues in the SEC filings. Now, if you think about this, this was sort of in the Enron WorldCom era. And, you know, the site footnoted has been around for 20 years, 20 and a half. Technically, we started in August of 2003 when my book Financial Fine Print came out. And so it was basically like my own examination of my investment process and, you know, if you will, like a postmortem of what went wrong. How did I get this so wrong? And it was part of an educational process. And that's what started, you know, when I published the book, I started the website, and it's been going ever since.
And so you kind of, you know, you specialize and you've kind of really sort of dived into this kind of world of uncovering sort of juicy information that's hidden in company filings. I mean, what are some of the ways that companies typically kind of try to soften something that's negative or hide it in a company, in an SEC filing?
Well, my favorite is they file late on a Friday afternoon. So the US markets, and I should, you know, emphasize obviously, because everything I'm doing is SEC based. So even though I'm based in Paris these days, my primary focus is on the US markets. After 4 p.m. Eastern time on a Friday afternoon, companies, you know, the market closes, but the SEC remains open for another 90 minutes. And that's when you see a lot of companies taking out the trash. They think like nobody's paying attention, the market's closed. Sometimes they'll file even later on a Friday evening, you know, so the SEC remains open for 8Ks, which is primarily what I'm looking at. 8Ks are, you know, for those people who may not be familiar, are sort of the news release, if you will. It's not really that. It's information that a typical investor would need to know. And that's what an 8K primarily is. And it can be anything from like a CFO resigning to we think we're going to, you know, be facing this big lawsuit or an investigation, you know, it could, or we've hired, you know, a new CEO. Although usually that's not buried on a Friday night. I would say in general, the information that's put out late on a Friday is going to be negative information in one form or another. Maybe the audit committee chairman resigned, something along those lines. And so companies do that, and we, you know, we try to catch a lot of that.
What's, do you have any kind of particular bugbears about the ways that companies try to hide information like this?
I think, you know, if I could, you know, think of one thing, it's just, you know, get the information out there instead of trying to, you know, make it harder to find. So one of my favorite bugbears, if you will, would be a company would say, you know, they put out an 8K on a Friday evening, and they'll say John Doe stepped down from the board effective, you know, a week ago, whatever. You know, they have 4 days under the rules of 8Ks. You have 4 business days to disclose what's going on. So, you know, if someone resigns on a Monday, you really don't have to disclose it until Friday. So they take the full amount of time to disclose it. And then they don't tell you in the filing that, you know, maybe he was the former chairman of the board, or he was the head of the audit committee. And, you know, just this past week, for example, I was looking at a filing, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the company right now. But they actually said that this woman had resigned from the board, that she was on the audit committee, and that as a result of her resignation, the company was now going to be out of compliance with NASDAQ and with SEC rules on having 3 independent audit committee members. And I remember thinking, like, this is like probably the first time I've seen all 3 pieces of the information. Normally, you just get the person's name, and then you have to go back to the proxy and see, well, were they on the audit committee? I mean, the person writing the filing clearly knows what committee they're on. So why not just tell it? Why not just put it out there instead of making people dig for it?
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you about climate rules. Obviously, everybody's had their eyes on the SEC and climate rules and what's going to happen going forward. I mean, what are your expectations when it comes to how companies are going to respond to some of these regulations in their filings?
I think, like a lot of things in the United States, it's going to wind up in litigation. And, you know, with the election coming up in 6 or so months, I think it's TBD, to be determined, because I would fully expect, for example, if Trump were to win re-election, that those rules would disappear probably relatively quickly. Again, I have no particular insight into the election process or anything like that, or the inner workings of the SEC, but that would be my expectation. I mean, the pendulum tends to swing one way and then it swings the other way, depending on who's running the SEC. And so I think, you know, you're seeing some of these, you know, the rules were certainly interesting. You know, it took a long time for them to promulgate those rules. I mean, you look back to, like, for example, you know, within the past couple of months, you know, not climate related, but they, you know, the SEC recently came out with SPAC rules. Well, the SPAC mess was taking place in 2020 and 2021. So it's almost like we wrote these rules, but like when they needed to write the rules, it was like, you know, a couple of years ago. So I think it's often the case. I mean, you know, will these rules, will you start seeing information on these climate disclosures anytime soon? My guess is some companies will, you know, sort of honor the spirit of the rules, if you will, and other companies will take a very much of a wait and see approach and wait until this whole thing plays out. But I don't expect this to be decided anytime soon, or even, I guess, make it through, you know, depending on what happens in November, what happens then.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about some of the, if you can share some of the kind of more memorable things that you've dug up from company filings.
You know, there's just always some crazy things. I mean, I think about like a disclosure last year about DraftKings paying for a Super Bowl weekend in Los Angeles for the company CEO and his family. And they spent like something, they disclosed like spending about $135,000 on sending this guy and his family to the Super Bowl. Now, again, I think you can maybe make an argument that a company like DraftKings, which is in the, you know, betting business and so on, you know, would want to go to the Super Bowl. But the whole family, I mean, most of us don't spend $135,000 on a weekend, right? Yeah. I don't know about you, Garnet, but I don't.
I mean, so far this year, I've reined it in, but.
Okay. I'm just trying to think of how you could even spend $135,000 in a weekend. I mean, I guess if I chartered a private plane to take me to, I don't know, Australia, maybe I could rack it up. You know, that's a lot of money. And so, you know, that's the disclosure. I think the things that stick out to me are just some of the crazy perks. I mean, one of them was early on. It was Quest. And this was, you know, going back, you know, quite a long time ago. But they were using the corporate jet to ferry the CEO's stepdaughter between San Francisco and Denver. And I thought, what is a 16-year-old girl doing on a private jet? You know, disclosures like that. I think like anytime you see these excessive perks, I mean, look at Meta. You know, they make a big deal about how Mark Zuckerberg only gets $1 a year in salary. But, you know, his security costs are north of $25 million a year. Mm-hmm. And that includes a lot of private jet travel and, you know, security and, you know, one that stuck out at me. You know, it's just sort of these crazy perks that you see. I remember like the former CEO, it was Macy's at the time, had an armored vehicle. And I'm thinking like, is the CEO of Macy's really under that kind of threat? That, I mean, you know, I'm sure that the security for people like, you know, like a Jeff Bezos, like a Mark Zuckerberg, like some of these people is very real. They have families and they should be, you know, their family should be protected, of course. But an armored vehicle for like the CEO of a department store chain seemed like a little bit of an overkill. You know, things that just seem out of the ordinary, you know, and you think like, gosh, I managed to pay for my vacations, you know, on my much smaller salary. Why are these people getting $135,000 trips to the Super Bowl? Or, you know, why are they spending millions of dollars on the corporate jet? Certainly they have enough money where they can charter their own corporate jet and do what they want, you know, and why does it get rolled up into a business expense? Why is it that type of thing? So I think anytime I see unusual perks like that, it kind of raises my eyebrows.
And then I just have one last question. I was wondering from, you know, your 20 years of looking at all of this and the things that bother you, the things that interest you, I mean, do you have kind of one piece of advice for our listeners who are typically the people working on these and putting these out? What would you like to see from these releases?
I would just say be straightforward and be honest. You know, if the audit committee chairman resigns, just say that in the 8K. Don't, you know, give it, Yes, I know how to find it. I know how to go look for the proxy. But does my, you know, grandmother who, you know, maybe owns shares as a retiree, is she going to know this? Is she going to know how to look for the, you know, proxy information? You know, just if you have the information, I would say argue. I hear a lot of talk about transparency, but I don't see a lot of action on transparency. And so to really be transparent, you know, just give all the information. Yes, our CFO resigned after 6 months. You know, say it, like, instead of just say our CFO resigned effective whatever date, you know, and to that point, you know, I can't tell you how many times I see a company saying there were no disagreements or disputes, whether it's the audit committee, you know, whether it's the auditor resigning or a director resigning or an officer resigning, almost like well over 95% of the time, there's no disputes. But honestly, ask yourself, does someone walk away from a job that pays $500,000 plus options or more? Because, you know, some of these jobs pay a lot more. If there were really no disputes,
yeah.
I mean, it's like your BS meter goes off and you're kind of like, huh, of course there had to be a dispute because most people don't walk away. I mean, even if you're leaving your job at Starbucks, you know, you give a couple of days notice even. You don't just like walk off the job that day and say, to hell with this, I'm leaving. This is something I can't handle. And that's what you see in filings. You're supposed to believe, you know, you're reading with a straight face that the CFO just left and there were no disputes. And you're thinking, I don't know about that.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much. This is very interesting. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Garnet.
IR Magazine is getting ready to host its ESG Integration Forum Summer on June 27th at the Clifford Chance offices in New York. Join IR and sustainability professionals as we unravel the complexities of ESG integration and equip you with actionable insights to navigate through the dynamic world of ESG in 2024. Join the ESG Integration Forum Summer to cut through the noise and gain clarity on managing stakeholders amid divergent ESG perspectives, empowering boards with ESG for sustainable value creation, crafting investment-grade data systems for informed decisions, navigating SEC regulations, including the latest climate rule updates, and assessing generative AI's impact on ESG reporting. To register now and secure your seat, head over to iamagazine.com/events.
And that's it for today. Thanks for tuning in into IR Voice, formerly known as The Ticket Podcast. I'm Noemi Di Stefano. If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Until next time, thanks for listening.